Good morning. The other day I sat on a board to interview candidates for a job. There were half a dozen of us, and we were to see one of them at a time. A fairly daunting business for them, but also worrying for us. Would we choose the right person? Could we detect in 20 minutes of interview whether someone was suitable for a job that he or she should hold for the next 10 years or so? The first facts I learned were from their biographical details, their curriculum vitae, the typed information of their past. On reading all the pages, I came to the conclusion that one interviewee was way above the rest, that another was way below, and those that were left arranged themselves into an order. Part of this judgment was reasonable, a better academic record, a more interesting and relevant set of jobs, more enterprising sidelines. But part of this prior discrimination was plain wrong. But it just does look more fascinating on a piece of paper if the subject was born in Uttar Pradesh rather than Dulwich, if his or her initials are QKZ, and if their phone number is, say, 2222. The biographies were certainly a prior and powerful and malign influence. The first of the candidates was then ushered in. A whole human set before us, the living personification of all those words. I looked at the relevant pages, but he bore no relation to them. For one thing, he looked dirty. Where had that been on the form? And he had an awkward way of speaking and was diffident and high-handed in his manner. I didn't even feel like asking him a question, and so took refuge in his biography. Born Uttar Pradesh, good academic record, varied career. But what did all that matter when he was high-handed, dirty, and had as much drive as a cauliflower? On paper was one person, in the flesh was quite another. I didn't like the flesh, and therefore couldn't care less about the paper, however many O-levels and A-levels and honoris causae. Who wanted a well-qualified cauliflower? Next, we all said, and number two came in. Then number three, and so on until we had done with them. Only one person could get the job, and the person we chose had been way down on my list from the pages full of details, but top of all our lists when the real live person replaced the curriculum of life. They were as chalk and cheese, and we infinitely preferred what we saw to what we read. So I've come to the conclusion that a CV, as they call them, is about as revealing as a passport photograph from a slot machine. Like all those entries in Who's Who, there are all the honours. But does he love his family? Do they love him? Was he pushed when he changed from Ast Sales Rep North Div to Head Sales Rep Scott Div? Or did he want to go? Hobbies, shark fishing, reading. Does Ethel Jane McNaughton Fortescue, married 1962, go fishing with him, plus their 2S1D? Do his friends think him a cauliflower? And could I possibly like him, employ him, be employed by him? Speak, that I may see thee, said Ben Jonson. He didn't say, show me your CV or your entry in Who's Who, and then I'll know. Perhaps references are what we should go by. They can be very explicit. On leaving the Air Force after 4 conscripted years, I caught a sight of my character sheet. The first of 2 entries read, recommended for promotion to officer. The second, filled in 3 years later, was equally brief, not recommended for promotion to corporal. On the other hand, not every filler-in is quite so truthful. I once read, she is as diligent as she is honest, and only later learned the deep cunning involved when her dishonesty precisely matched her lack of diligence. I like the suggestion being put about quite seriously these days, that people should be answerable for the references they give. If loyal, obedient and tidy proves to be a sleazy, shifty slut, then sue the previous employer for such a travesty of truth. Which all brings me to the whole subject of whether the piece of paper is worth more than the person it refers to. I've noted a trend of late which is steadily putting up the paper qualifications for a job, and 2 that I've been following have been doctors and pilots. It would seem, which is no one's fault, that more and more people are applying for these 2 kinds of job. It would also seem that the basic sinning of applicants is being done just by demanding higher and higher A-levels. This is a very easy way of trimming the 1,000 who apply into the 100 to be interviewed. It's easiest if the interviewers state that there is no point in anyone who doesn't have at least 3 B's among his A-levels even applying. He or she is out from the start because their A-level grades are too inadequate for them to be contemplated. So, I was fascinated to read that a headmaster has been taking the medical profession to task in this regard and in the Lancet. He wants to know, in brief, how A-levels measure those much-admired qualities in a doctor of the human touch, of the wise philosopher and friend, of the bedside manner. Some medical schools, according to him, do rely on interviews provided the A-level grades are high enough, but others are apparently only guided by A-level results. This, according to the headmaster, is not how it should be. Let's think for a moment of some good doctor that we know. What makes him good from our humble viewpoint as patient, as sick patient, wanting to be cured? Well, it's nice, primarily, if he finds time to see us. Secondly, he must be responsive and attentive to our rather vague and incoherent catalogue of symptoms. From all this, he must somehow get to the root of the problem, give us such facts as we need, and the medicines, and get us on our feet again with a minimum of delay. What's all this got to do with A-levels? The answer, I suppose, is nothing. A similarly bright A-leveler could prove to be poor at planning his timetable, incapable of sifting the needy from the hypochondriac, insulting in his bedside manner, churlish of our sick opinion, disdainful of our own diagnosis, and then wrongful in his assessment of our ill. The pills he prescribes could be plain wrong or excessive or as harmful in their side effects as the original disease. The sort of questions and answers in the A-level papers in chemistry, zoology, botany, physics or whatever cover none of this ground. They are an attempt to assess intelligence. And that is one good quality for a doctor to possess, but it's only one. And it's also arguable, to say the least, whether an A-level paper actually assesses it correctly. According to the Lancet's headmaster, and here I'm quoting, most teachers will admit that a number of their top-grade scholars are complex, neurotic, unmotivated people, afraid of responsibility, lacking integrity, without the human touch, unwilling to work overtime, liable to crack under stress, and unlikely either to care for their patients or to inspire them with confidence. It seems to me that that is a first-class definition of what a doctor should not be. He may have 4 A's among his A-levels, but who wants that kind of doctor? Physician, heal thyself and don't bother about the A-levels. But unfortunately, the medical schools do bother. And that nice, bumbling practitioner in Bernard Shaw's Doctor's Dilemma wouldn't have a hope today, or so it would seem, of even becoming a GP. It's particularly interesting that a headmaster, who is part and parcel of the academic world, should be so against exam results. After all, exams, etc., have been arranged for the benefit of the educational system, and few would argue that teachers put the interests of the students before their own. It's far harder to assess character, drive, understanding, and the potentiality of a good doctor than it is to check if they know the cranial nerves or how to spell thalassemia. The headmaster wrote that efforts should be made to assess moral courage, motivation, determination, sense of humour, persuasiveness, integrity, steadiness under stress, physical energy, manual dexterity, width of interests, tact, ability to work in a team, ability to work by oneself. In one sense, this is like going back to the old days when someone who was head of his house, a fine fly half and captain of boxing, and therefore full of moral courage, determination, motivation, etc., should get the job when some weedy, pimply swat did not. It was what Richard Hillary called getting a blue to govern blacks. But the blacks are now over here getting their share of blues, and times, as they say, have changed. A-levels are now what counts. The headmaster's published anguish caused a flourish of correspondence, almost entirely sympathetic with his views. "The true and proper goal of education," wrote one, "is to bring people to themselves. By this standard, medical education is a conspicuous failure. In medical school, information is packaged and delivered in great quantities. No time is allowed for involvement, development of interest, exercise of self, independence, or self-reliance. At a time of great ferment in their lives, students are pushed into a mold in which real growth is blocked." A professor of medicine wrote that the profession was being endangered by large numbers of colorless swats. "We come to clinical medicine with humanity," wrote another, "and after 3 years, they have educated it out of us." "There's an absurd reliance," wrote yet another, "on A-level results at the age of 18 for a life's work." "Presumably," wrote the dean of admissions to a medical school, "we get the best and brightest, but it's remarkable how dull and apathetic they can be when they're actually on the course." Well, that's the medical profession complaining about itself. So where do we come in? We the patients, we who want a doctor that's good about us, whether or not he was good at some wretched exam when he was all of 18 years old. "I don't know the answer to this question," wrote the apocryphal student. "So herewith, a complete list of the kings and queens of Judah." He was right in a way, that lad. School exams ask for daft sets of facts, most of which are of no subsequent relevance. The trouble is that anyone should take them seriously, let alone demand that skill in this area dictates just who does and does not become a doctor. The A-level disease is rife. It's spreading into all manner of other professions. The selection of pilots seems to be increasingly afflicted by it. I know what I want of my pilot, and it isn't the ability, aged 18, to do well in his A's. I want him to be reasonably bright, but he must be brilliant in an emergency when aeroplane, crew, and passengers are likely to go berserk simultaneously. I want him to sit through the long hours of boredom, but with a hair trigger to alert him when all is not quite right. And, in ordinary circumstances, I want him to keep the crew working well, the passengers at ease, and the aeroplane running smoothly. A-levels? I don't really care if he never went to school, so long as he is good at boredom, at routine, and in emergencies. During the war, those of us who were at school spent a very considerable time not in the classroom. Day after day, we picked potatoes. That season over, we'd destroy hedgerows to increase an acreage. We smashed up saucepans, allegedly for these things to become spitfires. We legitimately took lead off churches, brass from anywhere, cast iron from everywhere, and we handed it all in for the war effort. I don't know what it did for the war, but I know that our exam results were pathetic. As so few of us achieved the normal criteria, matrix, and so forth, someone on high decided that, due to our diligence in destroying hedges, roofs, machines, and saucepans, it would be fair if they forgot the exam results and just gave us interviews. I know we were all relieved, but what I don't know is whether those they selected, by interview alone, were any worse a choice than those they select today, and increasingly by exam. For my money, a whole human being is far more interesting than a pile of biographical details, and his answers much more instructive than all his O's and A's. There may be some who are bad at talking, just as there are some who are bad at exams. But at least talking is a little nearer the reality of life than disgorging, in 3 hours and on not more than one side of the paper, a list of the kings and queens of Judah. Goodbye.